Thank you, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, it's very difficult to step in the footsteps of such a two eloquent speakers, so let me try to have another perspective on this. Actually, what what Tim just said triggers me to say, so sustainable diets means that we have to produce less. It's like with the food waste issue. You know, are you going to produce less as farmers? Are you going to produce less as food producers? Is that going to be your part of your agenda? I think that's one of the biggest paradox that we are facing. And I think this is one of the main messages that we want to relay with this study, which is actually joint work, and I'll briefly present my co-authors, Annette Freibauer, who was the chairperson of this expert group. Myself was a rapporteur. We also had Gianluca Brunori from Italy, Zoya Damianova from Bulgaria, Eli Farouz from France, Juan Girona y Chomis from Spain, Lance O'Brien from Ireland, and Sébastien Treyer from France, who is actually also among us today. What was the background of this study? The Standing Committee on Agricultural Research was actually founded in 1974, but only renewed in 2005 as some kind of sleeping body, which was revitalized. It is formed by member state representatives and presided by a representative from the European Commission, and more specifically, DG Research. Its objective is to advise the European Commission and member states on the coordination of agricultural research in Europe. And it has three initiatives. One is to come up with common research agendas, like collaborative working groups, joint program initiatives, to map capacities, and thirdly, to install a foresight monitoring mechanism. And it is in this framework that the study is actually the third study that has been produced in the last, let's say, 4 years. So the idea is to have a regular scanning and monitoring exercise of recent relevant national, regional, international foresight activities. So our study, which was released in February 2011, was the third in a series of studies. The previous one was issued in December 2008, and the first one was in 2007. So there is a more or less a two-year interval of this kind of studies. And what happened is that the Commission is actually hiring an independent, I must stress that point, an independent group of experts to do this the scanning. So if you read the report, you have to keep in mind, and also my presentation, we've been just looking at reports from 2009 and 2010. Yeah, and it ended up, our reference list has ended up with 200 of them. So there's lots of research, lots of policy documents produced in these last 2 years that we have been looked at. So the purpose was to scan those documents, but with an emphasis on resource scarcities and adverse environmental impacts, to look into the role of the knowledge-based bioeconomy, with a final aim to provide some building blocks for a longer-term perspective to prepare a smooth transition towards a world with resource constraints and environmental limits. So transition is actually a word that seems to be appearing in the European discourse the first time. It actually originates from the Netherlands in around 2000, where it actually was introduced in the general environmental legislation as a frame to get ready to prepare ourselves for, you know, tackle the kind of problems that we've been hearing about before. I'll come back to that. Because I will run out of time, my main messages are that sense of urgency due to resource scarcity accelerates, and this is mainly due to interactions. They keep reinforcing themselves. Secondly, the way we look at problems and solutions, we have been listening to Tim talking about paradigm shift and also the ARC. The way we look at problems and solutions differs fundamentally between a productionist-oriented and a sufficiency-oriented thinking. And beware, ARC, that you also are falling in productionist type of thinking. Beware, organic farmers, that you also are falling in this kind of productionist way of thinking, because that's the way we are wired. in education and elsewhere. That protectionist-oriented thinking still dominates, but I think we can agree that technological solutions alone are inadequate to tackle all these problems. And we need concerted efforts to enable this transition to a truly efficient, and we prefer the word resilient, agri-food system, meaning that there needs to be concertation at policy at all levels, in R&D, but with business at all levels. Three main leverage points: radically increase resource use efficiency, eliminate waste at all levels, to have new business models, that is to spend much more time also on organizational innovation, and as Tim already said, a healthy consumer diet globally. We also argue, and this may be a little nuanced difference between my colleagues here, is that we should not either have a productionist approach or a sufficiency-based approach, but we need to have all kinds of approaches, because the challenges are so vast that we need actually all we can, all the knowledge that we have, all the wisdom that we have. There is no silver bullet. And lastly, in research, because this was a research-oriented, so you have to keep that in mind, this is about agricultural research, we need more coordination, more true inter- and transdisciplinarity, not lip service to interdisciplinarity, and more room for system experimentation, not lab-based experimentation, but system experimentation. So the approach we took, and you can see here the overview of the report, is that we started by this what we called narratives of food production and consumption, ways of looking at things. We then looked into the biophysical, but also the socioeconomic scarcities, both at European level, but we really took a global perspective. We then identified some transition pathways, and then we formulated some of these building blocks. Not the vision as such, because we're just, you know, academics looking at what can be done, but just building blocks, principles of what such a vision on the long term could be. Because long term for us was 2050, 2040. It's not 2020. And then we try to draw some general research policy implications. So what about these narratives? In fact, there are many paradigms, many narratives, but we chose to focus on two. Narratives are discourses, ways of presenting things based on a coherent set of assumptions and principles underpinning and communicating a certain worldview. And Les Levitov has defined them as descriptive accounts. They are strong claims about what reality is, what the threats are, what the opportunities are, the imperatives are. They have normative accounts, claims about the necessary steps to be taken. And of course, they have a set of policy instruments that go together with them. And regardless of its stated aims, a dominant narrative succeeds in the normative sense of gaining resources, of gaining power, while preempting alternative future. So here's what we see as the dominant narrative. We call it productivity narrative. Maybe it would have been better to call it productionist or growth narrative. And this is the kind of wording, and this is actually literally taken from an FAO report. You know, what is the problem in this kind of perspective? Well, world population will rise to 9.2 billion in 2050. We have productivity slowing down. We have rising income levels that shift diets to more protein-rich foods, which will increase energy demand. We have a serious threat that food demand will not be met, with hunger and political instability as a result of that. By the way, there are also some resource constraints, some climate change issues that we need to attack. What is the solution? Science will provide, you know, improved varieties, improved breeds, improved technologies that will boost productivity once again, and second green revolution, but now worldwide, and take into account these, of course, these resource scarcities and environmental problems. And for that, we need massive investments in R&D, removal of barriers to adoption by farmers, such as infrastructures, trade barriers, and access to markets. You know, let it freely float against around the world. I would say that the catchphrase of this is more with less. And you may want to, this is actually also the catchphrase of resource efficient Europe. It's also more with less. The sufficiency narrative, on the other hand, of course, it starts to a certain extent from the same analysis of the problem, world population 9 billion people in 2050, it puts the environmental problems, we only have one Earth, more to the front. It actually acknowledges that the current food systems produce waste, produce overconsumption. We have mass health problems, as we have heard from Tim. The destruction of important ecosystems will have a dramatic feedback effects that undermine the foundations of our very food systems. But the solutions are different. The solutions are more about bringing the potential to bring forward more holistic agroecosystems, more productive, but also respectful for ecosystems and resource-saving at the same time. But at the same time, we do not, in this kind of thinking, take demand as given, and that's a very important step. These demand nutrition transition, as we've heard, these demand increases, China that will shift to a very large consumer of food, this kind of thinking does not take that as a given. That's why it's called a sufficiency narrative. It takes more behavioral change, demand mitigation, if you like, as part of the solution. It is much more in the line of what I would like to see as catchphrase, that less is more. And I think meat consumption is an obvious example of that. If we all eat less meat, we get more healthy, it's better for the environment. But of course, is it better for farmers? Yeah, and that's what I pointed to, the difficulty to get the agendas in sync. So I have to do the same trick as Tim did.
And then
start from here again. Yeah. So scarcity. Scarcities are actually most of our report is on actually making an inventory of the up-to-date knowledge on scarcities, and this reflects all scarcities as we call them, like fertile land, fresh water, energy, phosphorus, and new scarcities that tend to increase those old ones, and mainly two of them, climate change and biodiversity loss. Now, scarcity is not only a physical concept, it's a political concept, a social concept, economic, institutional. All these elements actually contribute to this concept of scarcities. It is a perceived dependency on natural resources and the fear of global depletion, but it also has to do with the distribution of it, access to it, etc. And also you have to look at all these resources in their context, their socioeconomic context, in terms of agricultural knowledge systems, which was actually the focus of the previous Foresight report. Governance, both the problem and the solution is in governance, global governance, regional governance. Economic development, urbanization, as Tim also pointed out, as drivers, barriers, but also solutions. Again, if you look at worldwide scarcities, this is actually from a famous paper in 2009, The Safe Operating Space for Humanity, then you can see that many of these scarcities at global level touch upon food production, biodiversity loss, land use change, freshwater use, phosphorus, nitrogen. They are very much related to food production. I will not bore you with an endless list of numbers. We all know, I think, the sense of urgency. Just a few insights. One is that economic development, as we are doing it now, is the strongest driver, further worsened by urbanization. Secondly, the amount of methods and type of food production has a strong impact on water, energy, nutrients, on pollution, and the consequences like climate change and biodiversity loss. For some of these issues, there is no shortage. It's more an efficiency issues like water, nitrogen, and energy. And in fact, if you would try to look at the combinations of these scarcities, but unfortunately, the scientific literature is still looking at these issues separately. We do see that phosphorus, for example, as an issue, is least connected to other scarcities. But we don't really have a real sound empirical evidence of these interactions of these scarcities. And again, climate change and biodiversity loss aggravate each other in manifold ways, but this is still badly understood. And the combined effect of these things makes food production systems extremely vulnerable. And that's the biggest challenge I think we are facing. I'll skip it. Some of these insights I really would like to invite you to have a more detailed look at the report. What these implications for research means is that we need to have a much better understanding of these interactions, of how these different resources are at global level, but also at European level. We need to have much more a linking of approaches, of technology systems, of basic research, of applied research innovations and application. We have to scale up systems research. I'll come back to that later. We have to apply a diversity of approaches to make the food system resilient to surprise and scarcities. And as I'm saying, this is not only applies to agricultural research, but I think to agricultural and food systems in general. So what about transitions? Transitions are processes to achieve long-term changes in systems to tackle what we call wicked problems. Wicked are problems that are intertwined. I mean, it's not a surprise that all these crises are happening at the same time. We have a health crisis, we have a food crisis, we have a financial crisis, we have a cultural crisis probably as well. So a transition entails a wide complexity of interrelated developments in economics, in culture, in value systems, in technology, in institutions, in the environment. But the problem and the big challenge, especially for policymakers, is that it implies a great uncertainty because the course that it will take is uncertain. We know the challenges, but we don't know the solution. We can explore several pathways, but which of them is actually going to bring us the solution is unclear. That's something that we have to find out together. And that's actually what transition thinking is about, to learn together what these different pathways, be them agroecological or otherwise, are about. We have identified three transition pathways, a consumer-driven pathways. We've put the consumer first in this report, which is on agriculture research, a technology-driven pathway, and an organizational innovation-driven pathway. We've been looking at each of these pathways in a certain format in terms of, you know, what are the facts, what are the major trends linked to scarcities, what are the drivers of these evolutions, how do they link up with narratives, how do they touch upon policies and research. I'll give you one example. I don't have time to go over them in detail. Food consumption. Facts is that we have this nutrition transition, an expansion, that we eat more calories, and there is substitution, more vegetable oil, more meat, more sugar. Some have called this the meatification. But this is also a fact that we see an emerging second nutrition transition, a substitution back to vegetables. The thing that Tim would like to happen, we see that happening actually in some, maybe not the UK, but if you look at some Scandinavian countries or the Netherlands, we see that already happening. And we'd like to call that a second nutrition transition. But we have still a bad understanding of the drivers of the evolution, which are an innate preferences that we all have for sugar and fat. The higher income, which is driving this, the lower food prices still in the long run, technological advances that make us move less, mass media, which has a devastating effect on how we consume, but also the structural aspects of food processing, food marketing, food distribution of supermarkets. They tend to deny their role or minimize their role, but they have a devastating role in all this, but it's under-researched. Again, productivity narrative takes demand as given, only considers this first nutrition transition. If you look at all these reports, they point to India and China as the reason why we should really boost productivity. It's really the sword of Damocles is China and India eating more meat. That's why we all should produce more. Whereas the second nutrition transition is much more the starting point of this sufficiency narrative. Okay, I had a second example. I don't have time, which is GM. A third example, maybe I'll say a few things about it, which is organizational innovation, where some of the facts are still increasing concentration of power and resources in multinationals, but the problem of us researchers to show any abuse. We see, and it's a nice French word I learned from Sébastien, the tertiarisation of food, making food a service, adding services and adding value, declining share of food, which is really food, basic stuff, food stuff. We see sustainability more, much more as core competence of these multinationals that Tim has listed. Rather than, you know, a strategy, it's becoming really core of these companies. And we see experiments with new forms of governments, not only here in the Commission, but also globally, like the Roundtable of Responsible Soy. And I don't know if it's a good example or a bad example, but at least it's an example and a new form of governance. But again, competition is one of these drivers that this need to differentiate, for example, is a driver that, you know, can work in either way. Vision: guarantee long-term food security, food produced sustainably with a territorial balance. I picked this from, you know, the communication. You all recognize this. This could be, you know, very valid pillars for a vision, but vision has principles, and these are the 8 principles that I would like to end with that. That we see that should also be part of this vision, and also I think for the new CAP. One is serve the well-being of all stakeholders in the system. Two is to use resources efficiently, but also optimally, to have this cascading principle of using biomass, for example. Three, to conserve critical resources. Four, to stimulate diversity and inclusion, because these are the only ways to have resilience and equity. To have true interdisciplinarity, and also to have transdisciplinarity, which means end-user involvement from the beginning, to allow for experimentation, especially in the long run. And the present agricultural research programs are not tailored at this kind of experimentation, to better coordinate and monitor research, and to stimulate involvement of the public. That means that in terms of research, you know, we see, as Tim also said, that traditional approaches are failing, but that we also need a new kind of paradigm that builds on science and technology, in which agriculture is a vital component in the management of natural resources, that emphasizes a systems-based approach to knowledge production and sharing, and in which that we have to take into account that the current knowledge infrastructure is excluding this kind of approaches, and that we need to embrace this broader set of understandings to really get there. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you.